Good morning. On today's programme, Canada's biggest military procurement deal in its history, and in Australia, a former nanny accused of torture and kidnapping for the Pinochet regime has lost her legal bid against extradition to Chile. First to India, where a census is underway to establish the country's precise population. It also seeks to establish how Indians live so that the government can understand what its citizens aspire to in their lives. However, raising living standards is easier said than done, considering that India is a developing country with limited resources. In addition, the focus in this census on caste divisions in Indian society, possibly the country's most dangerous fault line, might trigger social conflict when the final figures are released, as Sajida Momin now reports.
The biggest census in history has just kicked off in the world's most populous country, India. Around 3 million officials have started counting every person in the sprawling country so that the government can formulate development plans and prepare a blueprint to improve their lives. Officially, India is still a developing nation. An army of enumerators, mostly school teachers and assorted low-ranking government officials, has fanned out across 36 states, small federally administered regions called union territories, nearly 10,000 towns, and 650,000 villages for a business-like headcount. They will ask 33 questions to find out where India stands today and chart out the way forward by addressing the country's biggest challenge, poverty. The world's greatest administrative exercise to essentially find out what India needs to become a developed country will go on for a whole year. India's general elections, held once every 5 years, are an equally mind-boggling, gigantic operation involving millions of officials. The general election to elect a federal government have always been held on time since the first in 1952, 5 years after India won independence from Britain in 1947. The census, which is supposed to be held every 10 years, has been delayed only once since the first nationwide census was conducted in 1881. The last full-fledged census was held 15 years ago in 2011. The decennial exercise couldn't be held in 2021 because of the COVID pandemic, making the current census a long overdue exercise to map India through a door-to-door survey. The census has come a long way from its inception when residents' age, gender, marital status, religion, occupation, education level, and physical disabilities, if any, were recorded. From 17 questions in the 19th century, the questionnaire has now expanded to 33 and become pointedly socioeconomic for gathering data to formulate welfare and development policies. The questions will reveal the condition of households, including building material and amenities like clean drinking water, toilets and fuel for the kitchen, access to the internet, ownership of a television set, radio, smartphone, two-wheeler and four-wheeler, income and savings, and employment status. Details of fertility, education, and migration will also be collected to create what a leading economist has perhaps aptly described as a definitive snapshot of India. He said that a complete picture of how the population lives is crucial for setting up the right welfare, policy design, and public spending system that India badly needs for advancement. Until the last census, pen and paper were used. But the current exercise is fully digital, using mobile applications, geo-referenced mapping, and self-enumeration portals. Addressing a press conference, the Registrar General and Census Commissioner, Mrityunjay Kumar Narayan, emphasized that all enumerators will use apps to collect and upload data, completely doing away with pen and paper. Narayan added with a tinge of pride that a census management and monitoring system will allow real-time tracking of the progress of the mammoth exercise across all 784 administrative districts, in sync with India's growing reputation as a computer application and information technology powerhouse. Although the census is much more than a mere headcount, numbers do matter as they decide the per capita income, which is the ultimate yardstick of prosperity. In 2011, when the last census was conducted, over 1.2 billion people were counted. A few years ago, the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Welfare announced that India's population had risen to 1.4 billion people, overtaking China to become the world's most populous country. India's latest demographic figures will be known only next year when the findings of the ongoing census are officially revealed. Importantly, the ongoing census will shine a torch for the first time since 1931 on the caste composition of India's population. From time immemorial, Hindu religion has divided its followers into four distinct castes, from the high caste to the low caste, and the so-called untouchables at the bottom of the oppressive and exploitative social hierarchy. It is common knowledge that the upper castes have prospered at the cost of the lower castes, who comprise the bulk of the population. Dominant and influential sections have opposed a caste census for decades, so that the lower castes are not armed with demographic data to demand their share of the national wealth according to their population. Caste discrimination is the biggest cause of India's economic inequalities, creating small pockets of prosperity amid widespread poverty. Disadvantaged groups are naturally hopeful that the caste enumeration will result in their upliftment and fast-track their progress. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Next to Canada, which is embarking on the biggest military procurement deal in its history. Under the government's new military strategy, it plans to significantly boost its domestic supplies of military equipment and reduce its reliance on the United States. It currently is evaluating bids for 12 new submarines, with the field narrowing down to two competing bids, TKMS of Germany and Hanwha Ocean of South Korea. Both have proposed significant Canadian industrial participation using the country's steel and labour, as Dan Karpinchuk reports.
At present, Canada has four Victoria-class submarines purchased from Britain in 1998. They were bought second-hand and have undergone extensive modernisation, but they faced chronic maintenance issues and costly repairs, and they're considered to have only limited operational ability. Even before Canada bought them, the vessels were held in storage in Britain for about 5 years, and that caused even further deterioration. It's become acute. Vice Admiral Angus Topshee said last year that the Navy is down to one operational submarine. In 2024, Ottawa decided it was time to buy 12 new submarines. That announcement was made by former Defense Minister Bill Blair at a NATO summit. They were needed to patrol the east and west coasts as well as the Arctic, defend Canadian sovereignty, and improve underwater surveillance and defense capabilities. Tenders went out and the field was narrowed to two companies, ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems of Germany and Hanwha Ocean of South Korea. The deal, including long-term maintenance, is worth more than $100 billion. The deadline for final bids was the end of April for the South Koreans and the Germans to submit their formal proposals. Both companies have been told by Ottawa that their offers must include economic benefits to Canada. That has been part of Prime Minister Mark Carney's new defense strategy, announced earlier this year. He wants to increase military spending in a strategy that would protect Canadian sovereignty and meet spending requirements expected by NATO allies. The more than $6 billion strategy is more than just purchasing military hardware. Carney wants to increase the size of Canada's military personnel, transition away from Ottawa's reliance on the United States for military equipment, and he wants to increase the capacity of Canadian small and medium-sized companies to build and export military equipment, instead of relying only on foreign military contractors. The strategy also calls for building at home whenever possible, and for joint projects with allies. So the submarine deal will also have to include benefits to Canadian industries. Germany's TKMS and South Korea's Hanwha have different approaches. Oliver Burkhardt, the CEO of TKMS, says the German bid includes many of those benefits, although he's not talking publicly about them. Burkhardt says the proof will be in the result, and it's all included in the 1,500-page proposal. Ahead of the submission deadline, Prime Minister Carney visited the TKMS shipyard in Kiel, Germany, and he's been to see the South Koreans as well for a first-hand look. The Royal Canadian Navy has already said that the submarines offered by both bidders will provide the capability needed. South Korea says it could deliver four of the 12 submarines by 2035. Germany says it could deliver one vessel by 2032 and steadily ramp up production afterward. As for the benefits, Hanwha says some of the economic benefits include 25,000 jobs in Canada per year over the coming decades, on the submarine program, and an additional 15,000 jobs during the construction phase of maintenance facilities in Halifax and Esquimalt, British Columbia. Unlike the Germans, Hanwha has been aggressively courting the Canadian public with advertising and promotional material, even paying for a huge billboard in Ottawa. Glenn Copeland, the managing director and CEO of Hanwha Ocean Canada, claims the project could create 200,000 jobs in Canada by the year 2040. He says South Korea is treating the submarine bid as a whole-of-nation approach. Both TKMS and Hanwha have been crisscrossing the country proposing deals and signing memorandums with Canadian companies to strengthen their bids, such as providing steel for construction, training for work in marine industries, as well as other initiatives. There's even talk by Hanwha of developing a rocket launch facility to help Canada end its dependency on the U.S. and Europe for satellite launching. Just over a week ago, Hanwha sweetened its bid, committing to building armored fighting vehicles in Canada if it gets the submarine contract. It has already signed a partnership agreement with members of the Automotive Parts Manufacturers Association to build K9 howitzer vehicles and weapon systems in Canada for export to help meet international demand. Of course, Hanwha says that's fully contingent on being awarded the winning bid. The auto parts sector is now fully behind the South Korean bid after suffering job losses from U.S. tariffs for the past year. Hanwha currently has orders for hundreds of the howitzers from nearly 10 countries, and Hanwha is also saying what Canadian political leaders want to hear. These vehicles will be fully produced in Canada by Canadian workers with Canadian parts and materials. Not to be outdone, TKMS announced this week that it has reached an agreement with General Dynamics Mission Systems Canada to set up an undersea research center in Canada. It would be called Arctic Sentinel and would focus on underwater surveillance technology for the Arctic as well as civilian and military uses. Carney has already announced an ambitious plan to defend and transform the country's north by spending $35 billion on infrastructure for its military air bases and airports. One of the main aspects of his strategy is to reduce so much of his country's reliance on the U.S. for defense and military hardware. He's been traveling to Europe, forming new partnerships and promoting defense industrial cooperation and deepening security ties, even signing a new defense and security pact with the European Union. Carney has said the winner of the submarine contract will be announced by the end of June. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Finally, to Australia, where a former nanny accused of torture and kidnapping for the Chilean Pinochet regime has lost her final legal bid to avoid extradition to Chile. Adriana Elcira Rivas was arrested in February 2019 after living in Australia for more than 30 years and working as a part-time nanny and cleaner. Phil Mercer has this report.
For 7 years, Adriana Elcira Rivas has fought to evade the grasp of Chilean prosecutors. They allege the 72-year-old former nanny is guilty of crimes against humanity. She's suspected of involvement in the kidnapping, interrogation and disappearance of seven people in the mid-1970s under the regime of Chile's military strongman Augusto Pinochet. Her alleged victims were political dissidents, a high-ranking leader of the Chilean Communist Party, Victor Diaz, and six of his supporters. They're thought to have been killed in detention. General Pinochet seized power in 1973. His coup was the start of 15 years of dictatorship, punctuated by human rights abuses, including more than 3,000 deaths and 38,000 cases of torture. The general's economic reform stabilized Chile, but his legacy is one of widespread repression. He died 20 years ago, but his regime's authoritarianism still casts a long shadow. Adriana Elcira Rivas denies any wrongdoing. She's a dual Chilean-Australian citizen who served in an intelligence agency during the early years of General Pinochet's rule. She moved to Australia in 1978, but was arrested while visiting relatives in Chile in 2006. She returned to Australia while on bail. Miss Rivas lived near Bondi Beach in Sydney, working as a nanny and a cleaner. Her pursuit, though, of a quiet life ended with her arrest by Australian authorities in 2019, following an extradition request from the Chilean government. She's been fighting her forced return to South America ever since. In Australia, a federal judge dismissed Ms. Rivas's arguments that the extradition request was legally flawed. She could try to have that decision overturned by a panel of federal court judges. It is, though, unclear if the grounds for such an appeal would be met. Barring another court challenge, the former nanny will be sent back to her home country to stand trial on charges of aggravated kidnapping. Witnesses have said in interviews given to a documentary filmmaker that Ms. Rivas was one of the most brutal torturers in General Pinochet's secret police and played a key role in killing the leadership of Chile's underground Communist Party. She has denied involvement in any torture sessions. A lawyer representing the relatives of the alleged victims of the Pinochet regime said they were truly delighted by this ruling. It is, they insist, getting close to the end of the line for Ms. Rivas. Families of the disappeared say the remains of some of the victims were put into plastic bags and thrown into the sea, while others were put through flour mills and dismembered. Australia's chief law officer, the Federal Attorney General Michelle Rowland, declined to comment when asked whether Ms. Rivas would now face extradition. Chile's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said it would continue its pursuit of justice. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all platforms. We'll be back at the same time next week. Until then, from me, Paul Cunningham, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.
This is RTE Radio 1.